Greetings, warriors, veterans, and America-loving citizens from sea to shining sea. Welcome to Frontlines of Freedom on this Memorial Day weekend. Hoo-wah! I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Folks, please do celebrate Memorial Day. Be sure your children know that we celebrate this day to honor and remember those who served our nation in uniform and are no longer with us. Way too many of our children and citizens have no idea. Yes, children should learn about it in our schools, but it's really the responsibility of the parents and families to raise kids who know about and respect our nation. Okay, joining me at the 50 caliber microphone today is Marine vet Skip Coriel. What are your Memorial Day plans, Skip?
Well, Colonel, I am heading down to Missouri, you know, whatever you want to call it. Going down there, I've got 5 grandkids down there, my son, my daughter-in-law. We're just going to be camping a little bit, having a great time. I'm thinking I'm going to do some fishing down there.
Well, you know, there are fish down there, the last time I checked.
There are. I'm looking forward to it. Going to relax, have a good time, Colonel.
Amen. Here's what we have for you today. On news and comments by the Colonel, I'm going to discuss, Memorial Day. Then Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby will contribute his warrant wisdom. Next, Israeli Defense Forces Major Elliot Chodoff will join us to discuss, our one real ally, Israel. Then Colonel Matt Lohmeyer will share how he's helping vets. Next, Navy vet Ruth Ann Hunter will discuss her time in uniform. It was really interesting. And Diane Raver from the Garden State Film Festival will join us to review the movie of the month.
Hey, troops, please invite your friends to join us at this time on this great radio station. Then head on out to frontlinesoffreedom.com and sign up for our free e-newsletter. And join a conversation at facebook.com/frontlinesoffreedom.
We welcome your input to this show. Send us your ideas and comments through our website, frontlinesoffreedom.com, or by Facebook. And now it's time for news and comments by the Colonel on Frontlines of Freedom. We will, of course, start with the news. What's first, Skip?
Well, Colonel, the FBI abused its surveillance powers while spying on suspects in the January 6, 2021 breach of the U.S. Capitol and Black Lives Matter protesters, a federal court said in a newly unsealed ruling. FBI agents flaunted standards the agency developed for the Section 702 program, which enables spying on Americans and others over 278,000 times, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court said in a 2022 ruling, which was made public on May 19. But FBI agents have been violating the standard, the court found, with the newest ruling disclosing hundreds of thousands of abusive searches in addition to those already known. The abusive searches include multiple improper queries targeting suspected or confirmed January 6 suspects. In one case, widespread searches that consisted of over 23,000 separate queries looked for information on presumed Americans to see whether the people were being used by a group involved in the breach. Quote, the queries were run against unminimized Section 702 information to find evidence of possible foreign influence, although the analysts conducting the queries had no indications of foreign influence related to the query terms used, the court said. There was no specific factual basis to believe the queries were reasonably likely to retrieve foreign intelligence information or evidence of crime from 702 information. The ruling, released by the Office of Director of National Intelligence, also revealed that FBI personnel improperly surveilled a congressional campaign.
Folks, the FBI is supposed to enforce the laws of our land, not regularly break them. At the very least, all of the FBI's senior leadership needs to be criminally charged. Do you think they will? This is not the country I fought to defend.
And the media reports that President Biden will pick Air Force Chief of Staff Charles Brown to replace General Milley as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, our nation's highest-ranking military officer. Under General Brown, the Air Force has become the most woke of the major service branches. Last year, Brown, alongside Undersecretary of the Air Force Gina Ortiz Jones, the first gay and Filipino woman in her role, and other leaders, signed their names to one of the most shocking and destructive racist documents ever produced by our modern military. The topic of the Air Force memorandum was officer quotas set by race and gender. Similar quotas had been issued by political appointees in a politically correct military, but they had focused on slowly boosting minority officers rather than calling for a purge of white men. The 2014 quotas had looked for an 80% white, 10% black, and 8% Asian officer corps. while choosing officers by any racial category rather than merit is racist, wrong, and illegal under civil rights legislation. This fell short of Brown's proposed racist purge. Brown's quotas limit the number of white officers to 67% and cut white men down to 43%. The Air Force Officer Corps is currently 77% white. Getting it down to 67%, a reduction of 10%, would require serious effort to purge white officers and bar the doors to any new ones. Reducing the number of white men in the officer corps to a minority, 43%, would cripple the service and wipe out generations of talent, especially when 86% of pilots are white men.
Our military is already focused on political correctness and is rapidly losing its combat readiness. Who would want to serve in a combat outfit that judges people by race instead of ability? I'm sure the military leaders in Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea hope General Brown gets appointed. That will weaken our military even more. And in my time in the Army, we judge troops by their ability, and we did very well. This is insane.
And the Mideast-based commanders of the U.S., British, and French navies transited the Straits of Hormuz earlier this month aboard an American warship, a sign of their unified approach to keep the crucial waterway open after Iran seized two oil tankers. Tensions in the Persian Gulf have been volatile since Iran's nuclear deal with world powers collapsed following our unilateral withdrawal 5 years ago. The incredibly rare joint trip by the three Navy chiefs aboard the destroyer USS Paul Hamilton saw three fast boats of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard approach the vessel at one point. Guardsmen stood by, uncovered machine guns on their decks, while sailors aboard the Hamilton similarly stood by loaded machine guns as others shot photographs and video of the vessels. While the guard kept its distance from both the Hamilton and the passing British frigate HMS Lancaster, their presence showed just how tense passage for vessels can be in the Straits of Hormuz, the narrow mouth of the Persian Gulf through which a fifth of global oil supplies passes. Iran has seized or attacked 15 ships in the last 2 years. Eight seizures and seven attacks, Vice Admiral Brad Cooper, who oversees our Navy's Mideast-based Fifth Fleet, told the AP. Quote, "So, the shipping industry is mindful of what the security posture looks like in the region. We have the ability to positively impact that influence, and that's what we're doing now."
That was a great move by the British, French, and U.S. commanders. We have to use strength to maintain the freedom of the seas, and Iran is clearly an enemy to all free nations. We have to deal with them.
Women are at least twice as likely as men to be injured in Army basic training, according to data collected over 6 years by the service. Most of those injuries were musculoskeletal, meaning they affect the bones, muscles, joints, and tendons of female recruits. During 2022, nearly 30% of female recruits were injured on average each month during Army basic training. The average was 23% per month between 2017 and 2022. During those years, about 12% of male recruits were injured each month. The gap between male and female injuries in Army basic training isn't unique to the military. Female athletes are also typically more prone to injury compared to their male counterparts, with women being more likely to receive bone and knee ligament injuries and stress fractures, according to a 2018 study published in the Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation Medical Journal. Part of that is due to women having smaller bones and less muscle mass.
I thought we'd been told there was no difference between women and men. If these injuries can occur during basic training, how about during combat? Women certainly do contribute to our military's readiness. They clearly don't belong in close combat units. Hey, this could even mean men shouldn't compete against women in sports. There's a difference between men and women. And that's the news. As Americans, it's our responsibility to ensure that our nation is well-run and on the right path. Politics and politicians are confusing, but we can work together. Concerned Veterans for America can assist you, even if you're not a vet, in getting involved and getting our nation back on track. Working with them is one of the things I do. Check cv4a.org. That's cv4a.org. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. Coming up on Front Lines of Freedom, I'll share comments by the Colonel, and we'll enjoy some warrant wisdom. Then we'll talk Israel with Elliot Shodoff. At ease, troops, take a break.
Fresh, flash, frozen from the American farmer every time. PatriotFoods.com, hit the shop now button. You're supporting a veteran family in need every time you shop. Look at us online, see how we give back. For the servicemen and women of this great country, we are fighting for the American farmer. PatriotFoods.com, promo code FREEDOM, 10% off today, folks. Shop now.
This is Colonel Denny Gillum. I buy Patriot Foods. It's great. PatriotFoods.com, promo code FREEDOM.
This is Marine Vet Skip Coria with your Home Defense Tip of the Week. Sit down with your children and make a plan for home defense. Let them know that if shooting starts, they should drop to the ground for safety. If they hear breaking glass or see a home invader, they should notify you immediately if safely possible. If they can't get to you, they should hide until the danger is over. This is just one more way to keep your family safe. For more useful tips on home and personal defense, visit homedefenseshow.com.
This is Colonel Denny Gillum. It is 20 minutes after the hour, and you are in formation and listening to the Front Lines of Freedom all across America. Now it's time for comments by the Colonel. Memorial Day was born out of the Civil War, which ended in 1865, and a desire to honor our dead from that war. The Union veterans formed an organization called the Grand Army of the Republic. General John Logan was the first national commander. On the 5th of May, 1868, General Logan officially proclaimed what we now call Memorial Day in his General Order No. 11. The order proclaimed, "The 30th of May, 1868, is designated for the purpose of strewing with flowers or otherwise decorating the graves of comrades who died in defense of their country during the late rebellion, and whose bodies now lie in almost every city, village, and hamlet churchyard in the land," end quote. Because the day wasn't the anniversary of any particular battle, the general called it the Date of Decoration Day. On the first Decoration Day, 5,000 participants decorated the graves of 20,000 Union and Confederate soldiers buried at Arlington National Cemetery, while General James Garfield made a historic speech. Many northern states held similar commemorative events and continued the tradition in subsequent years. By 1890, each one had made Decoration Day an official state holiday. It's difficult to prove the origins of what we now call Memorial Day, as over 24 towns and cities lay claim to the birthplace. In May of 1966, President Lyndon Johnson officially declared Waterloo, New York, as the birthplace of Memorial Day. New York was the first state to officially recognize the holiday in 1873. It was recognized by all northern states by 1890. Southern states, on the other hand, continued to honor their dead on separate dates until after World War I. The huge number of our servicemen who gave their lives in World War I led Decoration Day being renamed Memorial Day, as all who gave their lives in defense of our nation were honored. With congressional passage of the National Holiday Act of 1971, Memorial Day is now observed on the last Monday in May by almost every state. This helped ensure a three-day weekend, Memorial Day weekend, for federal holidays. It's worthy of note that many Americans consider May 30th as traditional Memorial Day and celebrate it then. In addition, several southern states still have an additional separate day for honoring the Confederate dead. Here's a few things about Memorial Day that you may not have known. One of the earliest commemorations was organized by recently freed African Americans. As the Civil War neared its end, thousands of Union soldiers, held as prisoners of war, were herded into a series of hastily assembled camps in Charleston, South Carolina. Conditions at one camp, a former racetrack near the city's citadel, were so bad that over 250 prisoners died from disease or exposure and were buried in a mass grave behind the track's grandstand. 3 weeks after the Confederate surrender, an unusual procession entered the former camp. On 1 May, 1865, over 1,000 people recently freed from enslavement, accompanied by regiments of the U.S. colored troops and a handful of white Charlestonians, gathered at the camp to consecrate a new, proper burial site for the Union dead. The group sang hymns, gave readings, and distributed flowers around the cemetery, which they dedicated to the martyrs of the racecourse, end quote. Two, after the war, General Logan, who had served as a U.S. congressman before resigning to rejoin the Army, returned to his political career, eventually serving in both the House and the Senate, and was the unsuccessful Republican candidate for vice president in 1884. When he died 2 years later, Logan's body laid in state in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol, making him just one of 33 people to have received that honor. Today, Washington, D.C.'s Logan Circle and several townships across the country are named in honor of this champion of veterans and those killed in battle. Number three, Logan probably adopted the idea from earlier events in the South. Even before the war ended, women's groups across much of the South were gathering informally to decorate the graves of Confederate dead. In April of 1886, the Ladies Memorial Association of Columbus, Georgia, resolved to commemorate the fallen once a year, a decision that seemed to have influenced John Logan to follow suit, according to Logan's wife. However, Southern commemorations were rarely held on one standard day, with observations differing by state and spread across much of the spring and early summer. It's a tradition that continues today. 9 Southern states officially recognize Confederate Memorial Day, with events held on Confederate President Jefferson Davis's birthday, which was the day on which General Thomas Stonewall Jackson was killed, or to commemorate other symbolic events. Number 4. Wearing a red poppy on Memorial Day began with a World War I poem. In the spring of 1915, bright red flowers began poking through the battle-ravaged lands across northern France and Flanders in northern Belgium. Canadian Lieutenant Colonel John McRae, a brigade surgeon for an Allied artillery unit, spotted a cluster of the poppies shortly after the bloody Second Battle of Ypres. The sight of the bright red flowers against a dreary backdrop of war inspired McRae to pen the poem In Flanders Field, in which he gives voice to the soldiers who had been killed in the battle and lay buried beneath the poppy-covered grounds. Later that year, a Georgia teacher and volunteer war worker named Moina Michael read the poem in Ladies' Home Journal and wrote her own poem, quote, We Shall Keep the Faith, to begin a campaign to make the poppy a symbol of tribute to all who died in war. The poppy remains a symbol of remembrance to this day. And finally, Memorial Day traditions have evolved over the years. Despite increasing celebrations of the holiday as a summer rite of passage, there are some formal rituals still on the books. The American flag should be hung at half-staff until noon on Memorial Day, then raised back to the top. And since 2000, when Congress passed legislation, all Americans are encouraged to pause for a national moment of remembrance at 3 p.m. local time. Troops, the important thing is to be sure that you and your family celebrate Memorial Day. Be sure your children understand the reason for the day. And those are my comments for today. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. You're listening to Frontlines of Freedom, and now we get to enjoy some warrant wisdom with Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby. What do you have this week, Roland?
You know, when it comes to stories about the military, I have found that nothing is impossible. But here I am again, coming across a story I just knew couldn't be true. There's a Coast Guard officer who served on active duty until he was 80 years old. Impossible, as a Coast Guard has a maximum age of 60 years old. Dr. Earl Russell Fox spent most of his life in and around the military. He was the son of an Army officer, and he was born in an Army hospital in 1919. He joined the Navy during World War II, stayed in the Naval Reserves after the war, and then at the ripe old age of 55, he joined the Coast Guard. And on Veterans Day 1999, President Bill Clinton recognized him as the last World War II veteran still serving on active duty. He was 80 years old, and he retired just a few days later after serving the maximum numbers of years of service for his Coast Guard rank. Fox was born at Fort Eustis, Virginia. Army doctors believed the baby was stillborn and left for dead in a laundry bin. Only when doctors returned later to confirm the baby's gender did they find him crying in the bin. He studied at the University of Richmond before the United States entered World War II. Fox graduated in 1941 and joined the Navy as a commissioned officer the next year. He commanded patrol torpedo boats for much of the war, including PT-22s at Midway in an Alaska's Aleutian Island chain. While in the Aleutians, Fox and his crew were forced to abandon ship for lifeboats after their PT boat was grounded. Believed to be dead yet again, his personal effects were sent home to his wife, but Fox was actually rescued by local natives who took him in until he could return back to service. In 1943, he was transferred to PT-349 and stationed near New Guinea, where his boat was strafed by Japanese fighters. He ended the war in the submarine service aboard the USS Bang. When he left active duty for the Naval Reserve, he had been awarded the Silver Star and 2 Bronze Stars. After the war, he decided to go to medical school, and he spent 23 years after that in the reserves while working in a family practice. That was until the Coast Guard came calling, and he joined as a flight surgeon and learned to fly helicopters in the Coast Guard. He spent the next 25 years until his retirement as a captain at the ripe old age of 80 years old. So there you have it, what I believe is likely the oldest active duty military member in U.S. history. For Frontlines of Freedom, I'm Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby. Back to you, Colonel.
Thanks, Roland. That was cool. Straight ahead on Frontlines of Freedom, we'll discuss the situation in Israel with Major Elliot Chodoff. Then we'll talk with Colonel Matt Lohmeyer about helping vets. All this is coming up. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. You're standing tall with the Frontlines of Freedom. I'll be right back. Troops, it's time for sit-ups. Start with 50, take a break and do another 50, then stand at ease.
We were instrumental in passing the VA Mission Act so more veterans could have options and freedom in their health care. We're leading the charge to end America's endless wars, bringing thousands of troops home and stopping trillions of dollars from being wasted. Our key to success? You. We bring your voice to our nation's leaders so we can all have a better future. We are Concerned Veterans for America, the voice of veterans for freedom and prosperity. Visit cv4a.org to learn more and join the movement.
Friends, there's not too many things I enjoy more than helping veterans and eating great beef jerky. Now I can do both. My good friends at Tango3.org and America's Best Beef Jerky use the highest quality beef to make the best jerky I've ever tasted. Trust me, I've eaten a lot. But that's not all. They give 100% of the profit to vetted veterans programs, mental health and suicide prevention. Go to americasbestbeefjerky.com and order now. And at checkout, check the Frontlines of Freedom promo code. Troops, welcome back to our nation's largest military veteran talk radio show, Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Troops, please do send me your comments and questions. Email me through frontlinesoffreedom.com. It's an honor to welcome back to the show my longtime friend, Elliot Chodoff. Elliot was a reserve major in the Israeli Defense Force the last time I checked. So welcome, still, Elliot. I know you've retired, but were you promoted yet, or are you still a major?
No, I think I've insulted enough people. It's going to take a bit of a time before I get promoted. Okay. As long as they don't throw me out, I guess I haven't insulted them too badly.
Well, you know, being able to speak your mind in a country where you are free to do that, with maybe a few restrictions, is a delight. Yes. Elliot, take a couple of minutes now and share your background, where you were raised, what you're doing now, how you got there.
Well, I grew up in New York, went to college in Stony Brook on Long Island, graduate school at the University of Chicago. I studied political and military sociology. I've taught international relations, strategy, political science. I've been an officer in the IDF since 1985. And today I'm officially retired because they tell me I'm too old to do anything else, but that hasn't cut back my schedule. I'm still doing strategic consulting, still doing reserve duty. I'm still teaching and writing. So trying to keep myself busy.
What you're telling me is you're not bored.
No, not at all.
Well, you did move to Israel. You are now an Israeli citizen. You live there. You're in the army.
Yes.
And last Tuesday was Israel's birthday, 75th, yes, if I remember right.
75th anniversary. Yes.
It all started back then. What did it take, 2 days after Israel declared its independence or its new status as a new nation before it was attacked?
It was actually the next day.
Okay.
Yes.
So one of the things Israelis are familiar with is war, combat, whatever you want to call it, but military danger type pressure. Is that a fair statement?
Yes. You know, the history books talk about the Six-Day War and the 73 War and the 82 War. I argue that there's only been one war. It started the day we came into existence, and it hasn't ended. The rest have just been campaigns along the way.
Well, that's a fair point. You know, personally, I sort of divide things into two ways, and sometimes they mix. And one is a traditional war, the kind that I'm most used to, mm-hmm, where I'm wearing a uniform and I'm fighting people who are in a uniform. And to the extent, right, that we can, we avoid involving civilians.
Right.
And then there are terrorist wars, where terrorists target civilians, hide behind civilians,
yes,
do everything they can to don't wear uniforms. I sort of call that evil. Is that a fair separation?
First of all, yes, it's a fair separation. And I absolutely agree with your characterization of it as evil. I was teaching a course on this a number of years back, and a student of mine rejected it. He said, I don't agree with the use of the word evil. I said, look, I can define it for you. People who fly planes into office buildings, I'm talking about 9/11, are evil. And the people who send them are evil, and the people who cheer them are evil, and the people who support them are evil. What's difficult to understand here? And by the same token, people who fire rockets into populated areas that have no strategic value other than citizens of the country being in there are evil. They're murderers. And I don't think we should shy away from that.
No. As a matter of fact, if there's any kind of values that we should have nationally and internationally, it's that kind of what I call terrorist activity should be evil under every circumstance.
Absolutely.
Okay. And that's the kind of war that you have most of the time, right?
Yes. Here, I think one of the other big differences between America and Israel on this subject is that you operate in a dichotomy of war and peace, which I'm not sure is 100% accurate, but it's got some value to the characterization.
Yeah.
We don't do that. We talk about routine and emergency. So I was in Jerusalem with some people a couple of weeks ago, and we heard rockets falling, and there were visitors from America, some professors, and they looked at me and said, what's that? And I said, well, those are rockets falling. And they said, why don't you look nervous? I said, because they're falling far away from us. And they said, well, how do you know that? And I said, well, partly from experience and partly, you know, Danny, I'm sure you're familiar with this rule. If you hear the boom, you're okay.
Uh-huh.
And if they're close, you feel them. You don't just hear them. We just heard them. We didn't feel them. Let's go about our business. And they were a little shaken by that. I said, where the rockets fell, there may be an emergency. But where we are, there's no emergency. We're still in pain. And I think for Americans, that's pretty hard to comprehend.
Well, Americans, most of us, who particularly those who haven't been outside of our country or have only been outside our country on tourist trips, don't understand what much of the world is like. And certainly, I sort of thought I understood what was going on in Israel until I visited there a couple of times. Then I found out, yeah, I was naive. And I still don't truly know. But I got a better, because I've been there and have seen it,
sure,
as you said, happen. I never was in an impact area and don't want to be. But there's a difference. So the Israeli Defense Force, in both active and reserve, you're really never off duty, are you?
No. First of all, the military is on full alert under the most normal circumstances. Today, we're not really in a normal circumstance with everything that's going on, but we're either on duty or anticipating being called to duty.
Okay. Before we go on, one of the things that I know that you do, changing the subject slightly, Elliot, is visit the United States periodically.
Yes.
What do you do during your visits?
I lecture, I teach, I travel around to communities, universities, whoever invites me, basically. And my most common topic is an analysis of the immediate situation in the Middle East. And I always say that the two constants in what I do are, one, there's always something to talk about, and two, I don't always know in advance what it's going to be.
Yeah, it could change while you're getting out of the car, right?
Sometimes, exactly.
But you've had enough experience there to where you can pretty much handle it, I'm sure.
Yes.
Okay. This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking about Israel with Elliot Chodov. Elliot, a number of countries in the Mideast claim to be democracies, but Israel, and I'm a political science major, is the only one that truly elects its leaders, never had the military take over ever, much less periodically. Indeed, as I recollect it, the largest party in your government is a Muslim party.
No, the largest party is not a Muslim party, but there is a bloc of Arab members of parliament. There's an Arab member of the Supreme Court. No, in that sense, it's a democratic and integrated society. But then let me say that and I think you'll appreciate this as somebody who studied political science, elections are a component of democracy, but they're not really the measure of democracy, because there have been cases, let's say Germany of 1933, where Hitler was democratically elected and then immediately destroyed the democracy. What we call sort of cynically, one man, one vote, one time. I would say that a better measure, or maybe a good parallel measure of democracy, is we're in an internal conflict over judicial reform legislation. I don't want to go into the content in detail, but there's been now for a good couple of months daily protests over the weekend, very large protests against the government and counter protests in favor of the government. And to me, the true measure of democracy is that of the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands, of course, some of them repeat, of demonstrators who've been, by now I would even measure it in the millions, who've been to these demonstrations, when they're over, everybody has gone home in one piece.
Yes, sir. I agree with that. That and a peaceful change of power.
Yes.
When one person's elected and it happens peacefully. There's more to discuss about Israel, and Elliot's going to stay with us. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. Yeah, it's time for push-ups. I want you to do 103 push-ups. That's how many I do, well, some days. Then take a break to stay in the area. Elliot and I will be right back.
This hour of Frontlines of Freedom is brought to you by HelpVet.net. HelpVet.net is an online resource and information center dedicated to the welfare of those who have sacrificed for the freedoms, ideals, and morals we Americans hold dear to our hearts. At HelpVet.net, find information on benefit-related issues from education, healthcare, military pay, retirement, VA loans, and resources on education, finance, legal, health and wellness, the military life, moving and housing, travel and entertainment, and much, much more. Visit HelpVet.net, HelpVet.net.
This is Colonel Denny Gillum. This is the final formation for this hour on Frontlines of Freedom. We're continuing our conversation with Elliot Chodoff about our nation's most reliable ally in the world, Israel. Elliot, you guys live in a state of potential war all the time, but you do it and you still live reasonably normal lives, good sense of humor.
Yeah.
When I was over there, the two times I was in Israel, if there wasn't bullets flying, people just lived normally, though there are a lot of people armed and they knew what to do. But they're normal people living normal lives, being very productive. That was one of the things that impressed me most about Israel, was how productive the country and obviously, therefore, the people are.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I think that we came to a conclusion a long time ago that if we allow the threats to have a high impact on our lives, can't say they have no impact, but if they have a high impact, then the enemy wins by default. So you live your life as if there's no threat. I'm overstating that slightly. Many of us, myself included, are armed. We carry personal weapons. We're prepared to intervene and be involved. And of course, many of us are on immediate call for reserve duty. But until that happens, live your life as normally as possible and enjoy it. Because if you make yourself miserable over what might be, then you're handing a victory to the enemy.
Yeah, I agree with that. Well, I go armed much of the time, too. I mean, if you're a free people, you are free to do that if you feel the need, right?
Yes, absolutely. But then here I think one of the differences between Israel and the United States, and you actually fall closer into the Israeli model, is that our population is not just armed, but it's trained. And weapon carrying, here it's not a constitutional right, but the privilege to carry brings with it the obligation to be an active, constructive citizen in the case that something happens. In other words, it's not just for your own personal defense, but it's also for the defense of the community, the society.
That makes real sense given your situation, doesn't it?
Right. So here I'd make a distinction, and not to get into the American debate over Second Amendment and that sort of thing, but many Americans who own and carry weapons, I would not expect to be involved on the intervention level because they're not trained to be. And frankly, as you and I both know, an untrained person getting into the middle of something can cause, with all the best of intentions, can cause quite a bit of damage.
There's an understatement. So yes, and obviously you have to have rules that fit your situation, mm-hmm. and you do. And in my personal experience, it's readily accepted and everybody sees the wisdom of it. I don't remember a single instance where I heard anybody objecting one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely.
Okay. You know, I watch the UN and...
Oh, I'm sorry.
I don't understand why anybody wants to be a part of it anymore. I'm not sure that it ever made sense, but it certainly doesn't anymore. And from my observation, everything the UN does around Israel is terrorist supporting. Yes. I mean, literally, not just nice words and supportive, but everything that they do is that way. Am I seeing it right?
Absolutely. First of all, let's understand, and here again, you can argue that there are positive aspects to it, and the UN is a complex issue. But one of its drawbacks is that it's a body that acts as if democratically with an overwhelming majority of members who are not democracies.
Yes, well said.
So despots and dictators vote democratically in the United Nations. And I think today's world situation is good as any to point it out. Russia is bombarding Ukrainian cities, destroying them, and the UN is concerned with an Israeli government minister going up to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem.
Uh-huh.
And again, this is without getting into whether it was a good idea or a bad idea, or it could have caused incitement or shouldn't have caused incitement, or leaving all of that aside, the scale of UN interest in Israel, as opposed to its interest in the horrendous things that are going on all over the world, is clearly a focus on Israel. And I have no problem in saying it. It's driven by anti-Semitism. A good part of the world, unfortunately, can't tolerate the fact that the Jewish people have returned to their ancestral homeland. And anything that we do that includes breathing will bring condemnation on their part.
Well, you know, when I look at how the Western civilizations, Western Europe, and how they treat Israel, or how they don't yes. support Israel, not that they never support Israel, but
right.
but certainly way over half of their activity is, in, to use my words, maybe I'm wrong, terrorist supporting.
Yes.
I don't understand that, and maybe there's no understanding it. You just have to live with it.
Look, I think that, as I said, part of it is anti-Semitism, but that's too easy an excuse. I think that a good part of the world, and here I'm going to include the United States into your mix, don't fully appreciate who these terrorists are, what drives them. There is a belief that, and I can understand its origins, that if only we were nice to them, they would leave us alone. Because after all, if people were nice to me, I would leave them alone.
Yes.
And this lack of understanding that what drives the terrorists is something very, very, very different from the way we think.
Yes, sir. Everything I have been able to study and look at and look into shows that their value system is so different than anything that I can understand.
Absolutely. And you said something very important there, that we understand. One of the things that we are taught in our system, sometimes directly and sometimes subliminally, is if you don't understand something, skip it, ignore it, and move on to something else.
That works unless that something involves could kill you.
Exactly. I absolutely agree with you. But we have this tendency to say, well, we don't really understand them, so let's gloss over it. And maybe if we offer them a cup of coffee, we'll be okay.
But they want to kill people that they decide they want to kill.
Right.
And that doesn't work for me.
That's okay. We're in full agreement on that one. I think also it's very hard for us, and I say us because I'll include you and myself in this as well. although I think you and I have gotten over this difficulty, it's hard to fully internalize the idea that people hate me and want to kill me because of what I am, as opposed to because of what I do or what I've done.
Yes.
Okay, because, right, if it's something that I've done, I can apologize, I can correct my ways, I can somehow reach out to this person or this group and come to some sort of modus vivendi between us. But if it's about what I am, then there is no compromise. There's no way out of it. And it's an uncomfortable feeling. You know, I have to be honest. You know, I'm pretty self-confident, but sometimes I sit and think, you know what, I'm here. And it's kind of hard to get your head around the fact that there are thousands, hundreds of thousands, and maybe millions of people around who spend all of their waking hours thinking about how to wipe me out.
Yes, that isn't something that I would enjoy having to deal with. But that is the reality, isn't it?
Right.
That's what you have to live with.
But it's true about America as well.
It is. Elliot, it's very clear to me that we Americans have to stand with Israel. How do we do that? What can we citizens do to help and support our nation's best ally? What can we do?
As citizens, well, first and foremost, vote for candidates who are explicitly in favor of that. But regardless of who wins, I would say there are two components of what I'm about to say. First of all, learn as much as you can so you can be an intelligent citizen and advocate. And the second is be active about it. And active doesn't mean going to demonstrations necessarily. Well, that's one possibility. But even something as simple as when an issue comes up, and now issues are coming up on the state level as well as on the federal level, be in contact with your representative, whether it's your senator or your member of Congress or local state, or in some cases, even local municipal, and let your opinion be known. And here I'll emphasize, if you're against it, make very clear you're against whatever their position is. But one thing that we're less good at, and I think is also very important, is if you're in favor of their position and you support it, tell them so. And if they vote in a way that is along these lines, thank them for it. We're usually much better at criticizing people than thanking them for doing stuff that we like.
Well said, my friend. Well said. Elliot, how can listeners stay in touch with you? We're about out of time, but I'm sure people would like to stay in touch with you, know what you're up to. Do you publish something? Are you posted somewhere?
I don't publish regularly. I try to a couple of times, and I'm just too busy to maintain it. I have two Facebook pages, my personal one, which I'm a little bit careful about, but I have a professional one called Elliot Chodoff Lectures. It's Elliot with two L's and one T, Chodoff. And there, it's easy to follow me, easy to connect with me through there.
Elliot, thank you for joining us today. Thank you for representing your wonderful nation, Israel. Thank you for being a warrior and a patriot at heart. God bless you. I'm glad that we're friends and brothers.
Likewise. Always a pleasure.
This concludes the first hour of the show. We'll start the second hour talking with Space Force Colonel Matt Lohmeyer. Then we'll hear from Navy vet Ruth Ann Hunter about her time in service, and we'll review the movie The Month with Diane Raver. Of course, we'll conclude with our weekly mailbag military history and our self-defense report. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. Troops, it's time for pull-ups. Do 30 good ones, grab some protein, rehydrate with water, and finally, put a big smile on your proud-to-be-an-American face and send me your thoughts by email or on Facebook.